This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 29th of April 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the 81st edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. All right, for this particular number, I want you to imagine, especially if you're in chilly old Helsinki or the very Baltic Tallinn, say, that you're somewhere warm. This show comes at you in shades, scented by sun cream, a little burnt around the ears, possibly clutching a margarita for dear life. The contents of this show just seem to have come from warmer climes, cats. Here you go. I'm in LA looking around houses and finding art in them, all part of Paris Photo's inaugural trip from the City of Light to the City of, well, actual sunshine.
Somehow you have to respond to the house, you have to respond to the environment, give like more kind of boundaries to the artists, but at the same time maybe become more creative.
We'll be exploring the 10th edition of Indie Lisboa, careful how you say it. It's the Portuguese capital's celebration of their filmmaking craft.
We selected 48 Portuguese films, which seemed impossible when we started the selection, thinking that we could have so many possibilities, and we received 237 Portuguese films.
And we'll get down south and dirty as we chat with the director of a new documentary that tells the story of America's Abbey Road, the Deep South Stacks, the legendary Muscle Shoals.
The energy of that place has its impact on you musically, creatively, and such. And so I do think it played a part in shaping that sound.
All that, plus we'll get a guided tour of a show on the Philippines' crafty past at the Musée de Quai Branly in Paris. We'll enjoy a funky Midori House session from José James and soak up a minute of sound from the event billed as the largest ever gathering of people in human history. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, right here on Monocle 24. Now, doesn't that sound hot or what? So first, it's time, as always, to hear from this week's Midori House session. And this week, we're getting a bit jazzy, a bit funky, and a little bit soulful too. Warming you up yet? American artist José James first released a solo album in 2008, and his fourth title, No Beginning, No End, came out earlier this year on Blue Note Records. He swung by London recently on tour, and stopping at that increasingly loved and important venue, Midori House, to give us a taste of the new album. From it, this is Trouble. And warning, this session does contain about 100 tons of cool.
Come on, talk to me, baby. Say, don't say, yeah, yeah. Troubling me, we got to try and figure out some kind of way to go that we know. Hey, troubling me, me every time I step around way. Dangers flow, so we can let it go. Say, I need someone like you to understand my heart, babe, and my soul. It's on my mind, baby. Said it's always trouble, 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 and all my. Struggle, 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 struggle. Oh, 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 yeah. Let me say it again, y'all. I'm gonna say it again, baby. And since we've been apart, baby, I can't figure out which way to go in my life, yeah. Oh, since you left my heart and by my side, you'll never believe me, but through wrong and through right. I need someone like you to understand my heart, babe, and my soul. Yeah, it's on my mind, baby. Said it's always trouble, trouble, trouble. Trouble, trouble, and all my life lately call on me to struggle, 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 yeah, 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 yeah. Okay. I need someone like you to understand my heart, babe, and my soul. It's on my mind, baby. It's always trouble, 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 and all my life. Struggle, 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 struggle. Come on, talk to me, baby. 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 Hey, hey, come on, talk to me, baby. Come on, talk to me, baby. Come on, talk to me, baby.
Jose James there with Trouble, and there'll be more from that funky Midori House session later on in the show. That cool feel good amongst all the warmth? Of course it does. You're tuned in to Culture, where in a moment we'll be heading to Lisbon, but first this week I've gone West Coast. Paris Photo, the French art fair all about photography, has extended its range from the Grand Palais to Paramount Studios, and the fair last week in Los Angeles had a few sideshows too. Sometimes they're better than the real thing. Good old Pepsi. Last week I was invited to one of John Lautner's iconic LA buildings. The Sheets Goldstein residence is a concrete palace of impossible angles cantilevered out from the Hollywood Hills. Inside was a French collaboration. Curator François Perrin, artist Xavier Villain, and musician Nicolas Godin intervened in this amazing space to make sculpture with a soundtrack. First, I spoke to the curator, a French expat in LA, whose love of space got him out west.
This house, to me, is very exceptional. I would say it's my favorite house in LA. It's the Sheets Goldstein residence by John Lautner, built in 1960. And John Lautner is this architect who studied with Frank Lloyd Wright, so he's part of that kind of organic school of architecture where each house fits within the landscape, within its environment. And this one is quite dramatic, like sitting on the top of the hills in Beverly Hills, overlooking the whole city, and being almost like kind of a modern cave or grotto, where basically you don't see the house too much from the outside, but you more experience the outside from the inside. And so it's quite a privilege to be able to do this project in this house, you know.
And do you find that with this house and perhaps other exceptional houses in LA that people are keen to show off the places, as private as people are, if they've got a jewel like this that they want certain people at least to see them?
Well, it's very diverse. Jim Goldstein, who owns this house, he really likes to share that house. He bought the house 40 years ago. He's maybe the second or third owner of the house. And he's been working on the house for the last 30 years. First with John Lautner when he was still alive, and now with like Lautner's like former assistant, and has been doing an incredible job, you know, being able to keep that structure in good shape, but also extending it. He's building now extension outside of the house, and he's really, you know, this kind of example of person that helps, you know, like conserve architecture but make it move forward at the same time.
So there's a lot to riff off if you're of a creative mind, whether you're an architect, a curator, an artist, or because Nicolas obviously composed some music for it, a composer. There's a lot to go on in a house like this. There's a lot of secrets it feels like it holds. For an artist, there's a lot to explore, perhaps.
The place, I've seen like a lot of amazing party, an amazing visitor as the
there's some pretty good pictures here, right?
In the wall kind of shows, but in the case of the music, Nicolas looks at every house in his own way and produce a music for it. Me as an architect, I have my own references and my own interest also in the background of the architect who did the house, and we try to address that also in the exhibition through some of the artwork or the sculpture. So there's like a sculpture of Lautner in the bedroom overlooking the city, which kind of echo like a photograph of the architect visiting the site during construction. And so, you know,
it's like a bit of a friendly ghost there.
Yeah, yeah. It's a kind of an homage, but also a site-specific sculpture. And that's the idea of the whole project. Is Xavier is a well-known artist in France, in Europe, has been showing for decades in museums and galleries, and this is a kind of a new turn. But also me as an architect and creator, I'm very much interested by this idea of escaping from the white cube of the gallery or the museum. Because when you create there, like, everything's possible. It's an abstract space, and so, you know, there's no constraint. And as an architect, I'm used to work with constraint, and making an exhibition in a house create like a whole different type of project, where suddenly you cannot do everything you want. I mean, you have a lot of possibilities, but somehow you have to respond to the house, you have to respond to the environment, give like more kind of boundaries to the artists, but at the same time, maybe become more creative.
And before too much of that Californian Chardonnay got consumed, I spoke to artist Xavier Villain to ask how you riff on a space such as this.
The emotion that I had by visiting it was so much higher than expected, because I thought I knew the houses from books and photographs, but the experience of the LA night, climate, everything made it so more intense. So I said, okay, I really had to make something out of this Stendhal syndrome. You know this, it's called syndrome de Stendhal. It's when you collapse when you see something beautiful because it's too beautiful. So it's,
when you walk in here, it still kind of feels like that. It's such an awe-inspiring view, but the view looking back at the house is kind of what the rest of Los Angeles is missing as well.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Well, it's of course an extreme place. So, but why doing only projects in galleries or in a museum, even if they are very important for your career? I thought the ultimate place to show my work could be this house of the BDL and the Koenig. So I tried, and I mean, it wasn't easy, because especially before doing the first project, because it's difficult to explain what you want to do. And it's not like a photo shoot for an ad, or it's more a dialogue with the architecture and the disappeared architect. And it's also very important to have the people experiencing it. So I first saw the show when the first journalist came, and we cleaned up and we had a small tour, and to experience people looking at it with me, then I realized how it was. And it's a challenging space because it's so radical and beautiful that it's difficult to add anything in it.
Collaborating with François and Nicolas, that's a cool thing. I mean, it's lovely to be. We're really very lucky to be here tonight, listening to the music, seeing the work, being in the house and the whole thing. Is that another kind of thing that you have to think of someone else when you're collaborating as an artist? I guess you can be, it's a selfish experience, but you have to collaborate with the building, you have to collaborate with Nicolas to make this work. Is that sort of set you free, the constraints set you free in a sense as well?
Yeah, because it's to be able to do that really, like, from the place I grew up in, for example, in the suburban area, I didn't even knew that those things existing. When I realized I could have access to those things, like knowing those musicians, knowing those architects, or having any access to them, then I thought I have to do it, because it's almost like a responsibility that if I'm able to do it, I shouldn't miss it. So, and it's also a commitment to my own work, because I think if the reason why I'm not doing it is because nobody's asking me, but if I have the desire to do it, I should reverse the situation and provoke it and generate it. And it works. When you explain to people, it's amazing, because there is, for example, with Jim Goldstein, it wasn't such a communication or communion on the work, but more on the architecture. And then Noah is very interested in the work too. So it's a way to establish this relation. So it's a link. So that's what is great.
That was Xavier Villain at Jim Goldstein's place in LA, and that show is called Architect Tones. Google it to find out where the next house will be. Maybe it'll be yours, but probably only if you live in a modernist masterpiece adored by millions. Lucky old you, if so. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we're headed now from LA over to Lisbon. Independent cinema in Portugal has faced a few problems in recent years, namely state spending cuts and an increasing amount of Hollywood imports. But as Indie Lisboa Film Festival celebrated its 10th anniversary last week, Simon Tarek discovered that there's plenty of experimentation and sheer drive that is keeping the national film industry alive.
10 years after its first festival dedicated to independent cinema, Indie Lisboa is still promoting Portuguese film talent in tough circumstances. Cinema made in Portugal has traditionally been supported by now dwindling state funds and cultural institutions. But in spite of good intentions, they almost always end up flailing at the box office. This has created an inconsistency, according to festival director Miguel Valverde, whereby Portuguese films are increasingly popular at European film festivals, including Indie Lisboa, but are being overlooked the rest of the time in the nation's cinemas.
The majority of the films that went to film festivals and they are succeeded winning prizes or special mentions or even being just for the possibility of being in the big festivals, when they do the release in Portugal, they normally achieve very, very low numbers. If we are talking that films by Pedro Costa or Manuel de Oliveira, his latest films, made 5,000 spectators, you can imagine other persons that are not so well known. But in the festivals, at least at Indie Lisboa, what happened is that because we created a kind of community of directors, a community of producers, a community of our professionals are not as many as we would love to have, but they are very supportive one with the others. It's why so many Portuguese films have so many people, and even the older directors want to see the films made by the younger ones, not only because they help them in the films, but also because they want to feel a little bit the pulse of the new cinema. I don't know exactly how to deal with this paradox, but in film festivals, the Portuguese films and the attendance is really, really high. And then when, in terms of normal audience, it seems like doesn't connect.
Indie Lisboa is showcasing hyped films from around the globe, including Harmony Korine's Spring Breakers and British comedy Sightseers. The overarching impression of this year's Portuguese offerings is that of rural and or urbanistic contemplation, revealing a back-to-basics approach in terms of production and a neo-realistic sensibility that reflects much of the filmmaking seen in the country from the 50s onwards. Terra Trem, a Lisbon-based production company, had two films in Indie this year, as producer Joana Guzmão explains.
Terra Trem is a co-production with Venice Films. It's called The End of the World by the director Pedro Pinho. It's a film shot in Setúbal, which started as a documentary and then it evolved to a fiction film. And it's shot in black and white. And then we have our own production, Lacrau, by the director João Vladimiro, shot in 16mm. It was shot a bit far from Lisbon, in the north of Portugal, in a kind of rural area, and it's also shot in Porto. You have new directors who are taking risks and they are escaping the normal process of a shooting, also because they don't have any money. So they are taking more risks and they are shooting with a smaller crews and they take more time. And I'm talking a bit about my production company. We really believe if you want to make a film, you will make a film. It doesn't depend 100% on financing. A film is so heavy financially, and sometimes you forget that you can also make films without the obsession with the post-production, or, you know, you can make films who have flaws and you'll make a good film, like in the old days, I guess.
Portuguese directors such as João Salavisa, Gonçalo Tocha and Miguel Gomes have made waves outside the country recently, winning awards at Berlin, Locarno and Cannes. According to Miguel, this only echoes the rise of quality output from the country.
Here in the Lisboa, we selected 48 Portuguese films, which seemed impossible when we started the selection, thinking that we could have so many possibilities, and we received 237 films, Portuguese films. But then people were making films in schools, they were making films with some producers joint efforts to make films. Some of them received money from shorts. Even we have an animation that I never seen this in Portugal, an animation that would have cost probably 80,000 euros or 90,000 euros, and they did it no budget. So I think that there is so much energy with our directors that people in fact didn't have money, but they decided not to stop the production. They decided to go ahead and see what happened.
As Portuguese film continues to garner interest outside the country, it's up to audiences and decision makers within its borders to protect homegrown talent. For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Simon Tanner.
You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Up next, we're headed to Muscle Shoals.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Maranushi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we're taking a trip down to the Tennessee River to an unlikely little place called Muscle Shoals. It's a quiet and unassuming town that also happens to be the birthplace of some of the most incredible music of the 20th century. I'll take you there, Brown Sugar, When a Man Loves a Woman, I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Loved You, Mustang, Sally, Tell Mama, Kodachrome, Freebird. They were all recorded and produced in Muscle Shoals, to name just a few of the rich and diverse canon of music made there. It's a place with its own mythology and iconic status in the music industry, and where many a big name artist still goes to write and record. At the centre of everything is a man called Rick Hall, founder of the Fame Studios, who brought black and white musicians together at the height of the civil rights movement, and who struggled through hardship to build his business, which became the home of the Muscle Shoals sound. His story has been documented in a film, Muscle Shoals, which premiered last week at the Sundance London Film Festival. Culture producer Katie Bilbao caught up with the film's director and producer, Greg Camelier.
What is it about Muscle Shoals? It's just a little village on the Alabama border. Why does that music come out of there?
At different points in time on this planet, there are certain places where there is a field of energy.
I was on a road trip with a childhood friend. He was moving his life and his job from the East Coast of the United States, and he was moving to New Mexico. He said, I need help driving my car 1,700 miles across the U.S. Will you come help me? I begrudgingly said yes after going to the chiropractor a couple times that week in preparation. 24 hours in, we realized this isn't a chore. This is going to be amazing. And we saw Tupelo, Mississippi ahead of us, and we saw Muscle Shoals behind us. And we said, well, would you rather have the birthplace of Elvis, or do you rather have Muscle Shoals, where we were familiar with some of the music from there, Leonard Skinner and Duane Allman and Clarence Carter. And so we both said Muscle Shoals, and we drove backwards. And then we all started to research the musical history of the town that night in the hotel room. And we were like, oh my God, did you know this? No way, did you know this? Did you know she recorded here? Did you know he recorded here? Did you realize that they recorded here? And like, really, all that happened here? And so we just became fascinated that, oh my God, you know, and we knew all this music, but we had no idea it was from this little town, sleepy town that we were literally in.
Sit there in that studio and just find a groove.
And one of the things that gets referenced a lot in the film is the kind of Muscle Shoals sound. Can you just describe that? What does a Muscle Shoals recorded track sound like? What is that character feeling and sound that gets generated there?
For me, it's funky, it's raw, it It has a living, breathing human quality to it. It's propulsive. It's got a groove. Those are the words that describe the Muscle Shoals sound for me. Mustang Sally.
Being there does inspire you to do it slightly differently.
It's like when they're coming out, you're stab boom.
It was pretty funky, you know, that was the whole idea of it.
In the film, one of the things I really noticed was the way that you kind of portrayed the landscape and how you seem to want to paint quite a clear picture of what it looks like, how people live there, as much as the story of the music itself as well.
To me, I think landscape was an important part of Muscle Shoals. I do think it affected the music and the sound there. I find that your environment, you know, really can affect you creatively. And many of the musicians, you know, spoke of it as well, that their landscape and that their town and, you know, the energy of that place has its impact on you musically, creatively and such. And so I do think it played a part in shaping that sound.
The central characters in the film are Rick Hall, who runs the Fame Studios, and his kind of session musicians, the Swampers, who then go off and set up their own studio. They're quite unlikely characters in this tale. There's kind of a bunch of white guys making music, which essentially has a kind of black soul. Can you just tell us a bit about them and who they are?
You know, I think the things that you take away seeing them in the film really are who they are. Rick is a driven man, I think, which comes through. He's very driven. He was going to succeed at all cost and was not going to be defeated and had this incredible resilience to him and determination. The rest of the guys, I think, have this innocence to them in a sense and speaks to the fact, you know, that they never left there. Says a lot about them, that was their home and they loved it and they stayed there. I think that says volumes about them, and they're all wonderful guys who are very genuine.
I remember when Paul Simon called Stax Records, talked to Al Bell, said, "Hey, man, I want those same black players that played on I'll Take You There." He said, "That can happen, but these guys are mighty pale."
It's interesting in the film how you portray the civil rights movement. How much a part of the story do you feel that is?
I think it's a huge part of the story. And I think it also contributed to sort of the magic and the sound that, and the harmony that they were creating in the music itself was completely affected by the sense that, you know, here they are in the height of the civil rights movement in the United States, and essentially they're in one of the states that's the belly of the beast, ground zero for this, Alabama, which is, you know, was as bad as anywhere it was in the United States. And during this time, you had black and white musicians in the studio, you know, treating each other with complete equality and respect and sort of genuine love for each other. I think that's really special.
It's the first time you've directed a film. This is your directorial debut. Do you think that gave you a fresh perspective on how you put a music documentary together?
You only get that shot of something completely fresh like that at something once. Once you've learned what to do or what not to do, it's not necessarily going to inhibit you from being great at what you do, but you're going to forever lose that very fresh approach and indoctrination and introduction and experience, rather is a better word, with your medium. And that's a great opportunity. To have that fresh approach can be a tremendous advantage for originality and creativity. It can also be a limitation because you can screw things up as well. So it can be a double-edged sword. There's a new generation of music coming up in Muscle Shoals, and I think it will continue because it seems to be a musical place, and that's also something we touch on in the film. But you have John Paul White from the Civil Wars, from there the Secret Sisters, the Alabama Shakes are from right down the road. Drive-By Truckers is David Hood's son is in that band, although they're not from there. Patterson is from there. Many other artists from there, Jason Isbell, all these other artists, that you'll see a new crop of young, great musicians. Some of these, which I just mentioned, you know, are already making a name for themselves. So I think it'll continue, and you'll be hearing more music come out of Muscle Shoals for the next decade.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. That means you're tuned in to Monocle 24.
Thank you.
Still to come in part two, we'll get all funk and soulful again with the Midori House session from Jose James. We'll get a guided tour of a show on the Philippines' crafty past at the Musée de Quai Branly in Paris, and we'll spend 60 seconds at the largest ever gathering of people in human history. One word: hot. So first to Jose James and another track from that new album, No Beginning, No End. This is Come to My Door.
Been distant now since you set out on your own. You told me I had to find something to believe in. Never thought you'd ever leave, but as you walked out the door, I prayed that you would soon find all that you needed. While you're out there on your own, if the rain starts falling or you get too cold, if you need a place to go, yeah, babe, oh, I just want you to know it's alright, it's alright, it's alright. Oh, you can come to my door. I don't mind, I don't mind, I don't mind at all, yeah. So long you've been searching now, but still I can see your face. The memories numb this pain just for a moment, babe. At night I lie sometimes, awake in my bed, repeating over and over our conversation. Right now as the moon is shining, I know you're out somewhere and you're doing fine. But if you ever feel alone, baby, oh, I just want you to know it's alright, it's alright, it's alright. Oh, you can come to my door. I don't mind, I don't mind, I don't mind at all. And on that fateful day, yeah, you know I will be waiting. Oh, you smile at me then say you love me all along. Then you come home. Oh, I just want you to know it's alright, it's alright, it's alright. Yeah, baby. Oh, you can come to my door. I don't mind, I don't mind, I don't mind at all. Oh, I just want you to know it's alright, it's alright, it's alright. Oh, you can come to my door. I don't mind, I don't mind, I don't mind.
The people I love are like Nina Simone or Carole King. Who they do a lot of different stuff, but they're just known for quality. So I'm hopefully that's what I'm going to be known for, and when I can look back. But it's definitely been a confusing thing for, not really for audiences, but just think for the industry. It's like, where do we put him?
Yeah, right.
Because I like to do everything.
Which section of the record store does your CD sit in, I guess? It's nice if it can sit in two, though, right?
Yeah.
It always helps.
Yeah. Which, actually, on this one, it has been.
Okay.
In both jazz and R&B, which is great.
And you played an Al Green track first for us.
Yeah.
What about him? Because people, we now think of him as a soul person, or maybe even a gospel person. But then maybe he was just a pop singer, right?
So, well, and he started as a jazz singer, which is even more crazy. Yeah. But yeah, he's and kind of country too.
Yeah, right.
In a way, yeah.
Exactly. That's because he always wore boots with spurs on. That's a little known fact about Al Green.
And no shirt with a vest.
No, indeed. And one of those little string ties. Yeah. Never seen without one. Al Green, famous for it. I wanted to also ask you about recording for the first time for Blue Note Records. Mm. What does that feel like? Is there a bit of weight of history pressing upon you, or is it a kind of inspiring thing to be on that label?
Well, I think the fact that they brought in Don Wise as the president just clearly changes everything. You know, he's known for, you know, rock and pop, John Mayer, and, you know, cool stuff.
But
you know,
different vibe to what it was known for, Kelly. Right?
Yeah. So he, you know, he really just took the mission statement, which is we want to put out the best of the music now, contemporary music. And I think that's what they're doing. You know, this year is really exciting. I'm doing some producing for them too. And to be on that label is just fantastic.
And is that a kind of structure thing as well? You said you're going to do some producing for them. That must be a nice thing to do, to kind of broaden your palette a bit and clearly work with other people for them.
Absolutely.
To kind of adopt some of your style, some of your soul, some of your jazz kind of grooves on there as well. Is like a record label like Blue Note still a structural thing like we thought about labels maybe in the old days?
I think it is right now very much kind of in an old school, kind of an indie way.
Yeah.
In a great way. It's like, oh, we got an in-house producer, Robert Glasper, Jose James, you know, let's hook them up with different people and try stuff.
Because that seems like definitely an old school way of doing things, right?
Yeah,
you get
people
on the roster and you're like, well, you guys should work together and this should happen. And that's kind of a nice thing. We think maybe record labels is kind of just almost like an edifice nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, there's a big name above the door, but there's maybe not so many people walking in and out of that door. So it must be nice to work for a slightly more old school setup.
Maybe. What's cool when you go into the office is that they play music.
Yeah.
And that, I think that's the number one thing you can tell about a label when you walk in, if they're playing music or not.
Yeah. Like, yes, exactly.
You know what
some
I mean?
Of it is some of them I expect are notable by the absence of stacks of CDs on people's desks, the absence of speakers in the office, right?
Absolutely.
You did stuff for Giles Peterson's Brownswood, didn't you?
It was great, man. He's just such a he's influenced this album too, because he really connects the dots and he's a bridge between so many styles. He introduced me to dubstep and to Benga personally and these kind of people. So now, and I used to live here as well, so now I really know, I think, East London culture and kind of the whole electronic
It's quite a different scene. I mean, that seems very different to the sound of the records you've been making, but I guess it all filters in. Let me ask you about that. When you're writing a new record, can you afford to let this stuff kind of filter into your thought process, or do you have to kind of keep yourself quite pure to cut the record you want?
I can't listen to certain things, and I have to make a certain thing. I mean, it took 2 years to make this. What I sort of do, sort of cheating, is like I work with producers doing remixes after. So I have like Taylor McFerrin, Flacco, Faulty DL. And
so then you can kind of explore the different ways you might have wanted to take the record.
Yeah.
You can do it on singles or you can do it on extra tracks.
Exactly.
In terms of doing the stuff live, you're mentioning that you're touring Europe right now. How does that work? That's when it's kind of sometimes nicer to be a pop singer than a jazz singer, because I guess it changes the spaces, although the jazz space is a little bit more intimate. Certainly the lighting's better, right?
We just sort of try to do our vibe no matter where it is, but I'm really trying to look for venues that are just about music, not about, you know, the big thing about jazz club is that people are sitting down and it's mostly older, which, you know, I love anyone who wants to come see my show, but I definitely am trying to get more ladies down, and I like it when people are standing up having a drink.
That's the message Jose James is giving out. That was Jose James, whose new album, No Beginning, No End, is out now on Blue Note Records. And he's playing a few dates this year too, of course. Just visit josejamesmusic.com for more details. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Up next is the second installment of my Parisian adventure. Stay tuned.
Years of scouring the globe for the world's best baristas means Monocle knows what makes a good cafe, which is why we're making a great one. Just a stone's throw away from our London headquarters. Tucked away between neighbourhood shops on Chiltern Street and Marylebone, pop in to the Monocle Cafe for freshly baked pastries, simple delicious lunches, or a delectable dessert, all served alongside artfully made coffee, naturally. Have your cake and eat it, in or out, at London's new Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Now to visit Paris itself. No LA pretense here. We're off to the Musée de Quai Branly, France's Museum of Ethnographic Art that, for the time being, is highlighting the traditional art, craft, jewellery and bits and bobs from the Philippines. It's a rich history of gods that guard rice fields, ornate homeware, hunting prowess and a love of gold. Co-curator Corazon Alvina gave me a tour.
Some of these were used for communal eating. They ate rice all together, and some of them doubled up. When there was a ritual, they would be filled with rice wine, and everybody would have little cups, also as beautiful as these, made, and they would, ladle in and drink the wine. Anyway, I was told when we were doing research about this, is that the wood is so beautiful, which, by the way, you can no longer find now.
Yeah, what type of wood is it?
Okay, it would be some sort of iron wood, Philippine iron wood, but my estimation of it would be red nara. And if you look at the fibers inside, the way they are whirled, they almost as if go with the shape that has been given, the wood. I was told during research that the tree picks the person, the artisan who will do the bowl, rather than he finding the tree from which to cut and make this bowl.
So there was an idea of animism, that every animal and every tree, everything had a sort of spirit, had a life of its own.
Oh, yes. The Cordillerans, as well as some of the highlands people in Mindanao, were very much part of nature. They were animists, and so everything had a life, everything had a spirit. And that was beautiful because that, in a sense, responds or resonates to the idea of exchange. The tree, the leaf, the stone, and there were sacred trees, which, of course, was very much respected. Otherwise, the consequences would be dire.
We've moved into a part of the show now which proves that it wasn't all about communal eating and spirits and believing that everything had a life of its own, because we're kind of in the section for warriors now. Yes. Maybe you can show us a couple of these pieces. There's a particularly fearsome-looking headdress. Maybe you can tell us about this.
Yes. The headdresses for the warriors of northeastern Cordilleras, which would be the Gadang, the Ilongot, and higher up would be the Kalinga, and the Ifuga would be the hornbill. And this particular scary one, as you call it, apart from the hornbill, the bill of the rufus, you also have these two antlers coming from the horn of the water buffalo. Mm-hmm. These are very rarefied. You would have had to have been someone who was morally ascendant, someone who was probably the bravest warrior, and someone who could hold his own against the foraging neighboring communities. But they were headhunters, and so you would have had to take heads to be able to wear this. But the headhunting was not just for battle. In the studies made by certain scholars like Renato and Michelle Rosaldo, it was also some sort of release of energy. It was also a way of re-energizing from nature.
It's a poetic thought, but we better go and have a look at the tools of the trade, of this headhunting trade. Let's go and have a look at those. We're looking at a shield,
yes,
which is designed in a certain way. Mm-hmm. It's best to describe it as a pretty ornate thing, and it sort of echoes the shape. Some of them echo the shape of a crocodile, some of them echo the shape of a man. Maybe you can tell us about this one.
It's actually in the shape of the man, with two hands up, and then the center figure would be the neck, and down the down part would be the two legs. If you could look closely at the etched designs, etched and blackened design, they are also the designs of the tattoos that Kalinga, this is a Kalinga shield, that Kalinga warriors wear, that they are entitled to wear after success in battle, after proving their bravery.
And once you've got your enemy on the ground, Well, you can use the bottom of the shield for a certain purpose.
That is, we don't know now whether it's apocryphal. For the for a great number of years, they said that it was for holding down the head. But then recently, certain anthropologists, notably Dr. Brian Burns, was a Brit, and a dear friend of mine, he said that, they're not very sure about the purpose that he thinks that was invented by somebody else, and that it was such an enjoyable tale to tell that nobody wanted to debunk it.
And finally, we end up in a room full of gold. Feels like we're in the treasure chamber, set out like a constellation, set up like looking up at the stars. Maybe you can tell us about a couple of the things that are shining most brightly in here.
Well, I would like to point to maybe here, two of the most astonishing gold things. Is this tutubi? One of it is the tutubi necklace. Tutubi, of course, is dragonfly. So if you look at it, it looks like either the body or the wings of a butterfly. This belongs to the collection of the Central Bank, Banco Central of the Philippines. What is amazing, actually, is how each body is made of a tiny globe. And about five or six globes are put together and flattened. And then an entire three rows of neck pieces or necklace is combined to make a three-tiered choker, as we call it. Nothing comes close to this in what is in the present landscape of Philippine archaeological gold, as it appears in the Philippines or elsewhere. And then another one would be the belt. Mm-hmm. Either one of these two belts. One belongs to a private collector, Maria Cristina Olbes. The other one belongs to the Banco Central ng Pilipinas again. And both of these are more than a kilo each.
They look very heavy. That looks like something you could only wear for a ceremony.
Yes, they are ceremonial. They were actually for the head of the group, as the groups have been established archaeologically. They were worn to catch the long tube skirt that usually silk that the male wore. But of course, these are ceremonial. But you wore your gold all the time because you had no safety deposit boxes anyway. But it looks heavy. Yes, they are heavy. But look how soft and supple they look. You can actually roll them. They're that soft. They're made of drawn gold thread, not woven but looped together.
So you could, what you're saying is you could get used to wearing this stuff yourself.
Well, it's a little heavy, and they wouldn't fit me. Although somebody said that if he were told by the bank that you can have it as long as it fits you, he said he'd lose weight overnight.
That was Corazon Alvina, curator of the Philippines Archipelago of Exchange, which is on at the Musée du Quai Branly in Paris until the 24th of July. Well, we're nearly out of time for today's show, but we've just got space to welcome back one of our favourite features for the week. A 60-second sonic spectacular awaits in this week's 1 Minute of Sound. It comes from Kumbh Mela, India's Hindu pilgrimage to a sacred bathing site in which it's estimated 80 million people partook in recently. The pilgrimage takes place every 3 years and ran from January to March 2013 at Allahabad, Uttar Pradesh. On hand was journalist Logan Plaster, who sent us this stunning Minute of Sound. The raw spirit of India's Kumbh Mela there, captured for us by Logan Plaster.
And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll meet the organisation trying to revive the lost art of letter writing and attend Gallery Weekend in Berlin, among other things, of course. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Band. My producer was Katie Bilbao, and Holly Fisher was the catalyst who sped up the science but wasn't consumed by it. Time for one final song, of course, this week from his Midori House session. Here is the none more cool Jose James with his cover of Al Green's Simply Beautiful. An appropriate way to end the show, I think. Again, hot. As ever, thanks for tuning in.
If I gave you my love, babe, I'd tell you what I do. I expect a whole lot of love out of you, baby. You got to be good to me, yeah, baby. I'm gonna be good to you. There's a whole lot of things you and I could do, baby. Yeah. Go on, Chris. If I gave you my love, babe, I'd tell you what I do. Oh, 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 yeah. I expect a whole lot of love out of you. Yeah.